Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode here of Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Forensic Science, Then and Now, an interview with Jay Jarvis. You are going to learn all about forensic science and so much more with this interview. So this is going to be 60 minutes of action-packed interview. Well, I'll let you know that all of our shows here on Crime and or on Suspense Radio Network are brought to you by Kensington Books. Check out KensingtonBooks.com for more information on their authors and their new releases, and also Baker Publishing Revel Books. See what they have going on. So without any further ado, let's run it over to them, because here's your host of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Crime and Science Radio. We're very happy to be speaking today with Jay Jarvis, who really has taken on leadership positions so often in forensic science in the U.S. He has over 35 years of experience in working in the field, and he's served on the American Society of Crime Lab Directors and the American Society of Crime Lab Directors Laboratory Accreditation Board, both of those boards. And he's also written the history of the establishment of the first crime lab in Georgia. He currently operates a private forensics lab, Arma Forensics, which specializes in firearms evidence. He's active in his church and community. He's going to talk to us about forensic science, past, present, future, so, and many other topics. So thank you for being here today. Jay, it's great to be talking to you.
Well, thank you so much, Jan. It's quite an honor and a privilege to be with you guys tonight, and look forward to the show.
Well, yeah, Jay, welcome. Great to have you here. Let's start by digging into your background a little bit and a little about you. What led you down the path to forensic science in the first place?
Well, Doug, I guess I can go back to kind of my childhood, which is kind of really where I guess it kind of all begins. I grew up on Long Island, New York, and when I was... You know, seems like I always had an interest in science. I mean, as far back as almost I can remember, and I guess like, you know, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th grade, I remember I always, you know, kind of gravitated towards science. I just liked it. And when I got into high school, I was rather fortunate that the chemistry professor or chemistry teacher I had when I was a junior had some sort of a contact with somebody at the New York PD Crime Laboratory in New York City, which was, you know, about a 40-45 mile ride in from where I lived. And he took a group of students to the lab on a tour. And that's really where I kind of really got the bug on forensics, I think. I wanted to work in the science field, but wanted to do something that was a little bit more interesting than just research. I was also involved in a local volunteer fire department at the time when I was in high school, toward the end of my high school years, and used to hear about fire investigations, and I used to hear, you know, how they would collect samples and send them off to a laboratory, and they'd detect gasoline and other types of accelerants. So all this stuff kind of came together, and you know, there was also a TV show that kind of came around at that time that some folks might remember. It was called Quincy M.E. Jack Klugman played the lead role as Quincy, and of course at that point, I think I related more to to one of the other characters on the show. There was a fellow his name was Sam Fujiyama in the show, and he was actually played by an actor, I think his name was Robert Ito. And he was kind of more the lab rat So I think I identified with him more as opposed to being the medical examiner. Yeah, so, you know, at that time, you know, forensics was not, you know, the big thing it is today. You know, there was very few television shows, and you saw very little forensics even on television, even in crime shows. So it was kind of unusual for people in that era to kind of actually want to go into forensics. Most of the people that I know that got into forensics back in that time were people that had gone and maybe got a chemistry degree or another science degree, and when they got out of college, they start looking for a job, and, you know, they found out that there was some crime lab hiring people with a science degree, so that's a lot of people, that's how they got into it. Because back in the late 70s, when I broke into the field, there was a lot of federal money being thrown out to crime labs through an organization known as the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, and there were a lot of grants that were being given out to labs to be able to expand and hire additional people, because the demand for forensic service was really growing back then. So you know, I kind of came in at a growing time and an exciting time, I think.
Well, I think Quincy was and Jack Klugman was everybody's introduction to death investigation. Everybody still believes that was all true. and he was a great character.
Well, he was.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, you spent 32 years with the Georgia Bureau of Investigations Crime Lab in Atlanta, nearby there. I think you began in like 1979, which was like ancient history in the forensic science world. What were things like when you started there? What kinds of testing actually went on in your lab at that time?
Well, Doug, when I came to Atlanta in 79 after graduate school, our main laboratory was located in the Atlanta area. It was the only what we call a full-service laboratory that it provided the full spectrum of forensic services from forensic pathology, you know, all the way down to drug chemistry. But the lab was located in what would be considered today pretty Spartan facilities. We were in a building that actually still exists. In fact, about a month ago, I actually had the opportunity to kind of walk through the old building. It's actually the Georgia State Patrol headquarters building. It was constructed in 1957, so it's really past its prime. And of course, now there's no laboratory facilities at all in there. But it was kind of interesting walking through that building, and you know, places that used to be laboratories are now offices. But when the building was first built in 57, it just the lab only occupied just one small wing of the building. But by the time I came in 1979, they had spread all over the place. The lab had grown, the demand for services had grown, and it was just a time they were hiring a lot of people, and I kind of benefited from that. One of the things that I remember that was kind of interesting when I first started there. The Georgia lab system had just brought online a computerized record system, and all their case information was being collected on a computer. Case reports were being generated using a computer, and you know, beginning with some of the disciplines, and it gradually moved to where, you know, every discipline was using the computer to generate their reports. I think probably by about 1981. When I first started writing my own reports, we were still kind of writing them out by hand, and then you'd hand them off to the clerical staff, and they would type them up on a typewriter. But the sections that I worked in, firearms and trace, back then, we started doing reports probably by computer at the very end, after everybody else had sort of worked all the bugs out. So it was nice, but. What I remember is Georgia was really the first lab system to utilize a computer to start keeping records. It was kind of an unheard of thing back then. And of course, even you think about that now, today, I mean, everybody does that. So, again, I said, you know, Atlanta was the headquarters laboratory. We also had four regional laboratories at the time that were located in Savannah, Moultrie, Augusta, and Columbus. And they usually only offered two or three services, and it was more of set up to be more of a convenience to the local law enforcement agencies, so they wouldn't have to all go to Atlanta with their evidence. And if there was evidence that they couldn't handle in a regional lab, they would transfer the stuff to Atlanta. We had a group of our staff that were trained to do autopsies, and they actually traveled all over the state doing autopsies, mostly in funeral homes. We didn't have any type of a centralized medical examiner system at that time. I used to, you know, even take some road trips with some of the pathologists early on, as I was, you know, trying to get some experience. And we had one of our director back then, Larry Howard. He happened to have his own private aircraft, and he liked to fly. And he actually managed to get a law passed that he could get reimbursed for using his personal aircraft to go around doing autopsies. So he had kind of a interesting little arrangement there. He could get the state to kind of subsidize his hobby of flying, but I guess it did save the state a lot of time and money in the long run, probably. But it was a very interesting situation. You know, like I said, the building was real Spartan. The equipment was very primitive compared to what we have today. But it was a great environment to learn. We saw a wide variety of cases when I was in training, and my training was pretty short compared to today's standards, probably. But I felt like when I did go out on my own to a regional lab in 1981, I did feel like I was pretty well equipped.
Well, it's pretty amazing to think about what changed within the next decade or so. Sorry, I think we seem to be picking up a lot of I don't know if other people are hearing the static and humming, but I hope our listeners can keep up with that. It's kind of amazing to think about what changed within the next decade or so. But before we go forward, let's kind of take a step back. You've done some really, it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing by recording some of the history of the lab, even before the time when you started there. You're the author of Georgia's Crime Doctor, The Story of Herman Jones, and the First 20 Years of the Georgia Crime Laboratory. I've read this. I really recommend it to our listeners. Tell us about Dr. Jones and how he changed forensic science in Georgia.
Well, Jan, I kind of have you to thank a little bit for the whole idea of writing a book. You may remember that right after I got involved in going to some of the ASCLAD meetings, I think the first one I went to was 2001, but then in 2002 and 2003, I think we had back-to-back meetings down in Florida, and I believe you came in and were our banquet speaker at one of those meetings, and you actually made a statement during your talk where you sort of kind of threw out a challenge or encouraged lab directors to try to, you know, do some research about the history of their laboratories. And at the time, in 2002, we had just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Georgia Crime Laboratory. Mm. So I was sort of interested in learning more about how the lab got started anyway, and then when you kind of threw out the challenge, I guess I got a little inspired and actually started doing some research into Dr. Jones. I'd never had the privilege of meeting him, but I'd heard a lot about him from people that I worked with that did know him. He was a very interesting individual. He was actually born in southern Alabama, almost down at the Florida line, right around the turn of the century. He got his education at Alabama Polytechnic Institute, which today is now known as Auburn University.
Ooh, Auburn.
He eventually became a professor there, a chemistry professor at Auburn, and back during the early 1930s in Alabama, they actually had a position that was known as the state chemist. And anytime there was some sort of a chemical issue that came up, whether it was a law enforcement thing or an agriculture type of thing, you know, that was like their scientific institute for the state. Mm. And this these problems were often sent to the state chemist, and he quite often sought out, you know, some help from some of his colleagues in the chemistry department. And that's kind of how forensic science got started in the state of Alabama. And, you know, Dr. Jones just happened to be there when all this kind of took place. And I think he kind of got bitten with the bug a little bit. He enjoyed the challenges of investigating some poisoning cases, you know, back in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And it quickly became a situation where they found themselves where they were having to, you know, conduct post-mortem examinations, because one of the problems they had was actually finding qualified medical staff that would not only qualified to do a post-mortem, but that were actually willing to do a post-mortem. And regretfully, I mean, some of the issues were you might have a white physician that may be qualified to do an autopsy, but if the victim was black, they were not willing to do that. So what happened is several of these individuals in the at Auburn decided that, you know, one of us has got to learn how to do autopsies. So Herman Jones basically took a leave of absence from Auburn and enrolled up at Vanderbilt Medical School in Tennessee, Nashville. And he went up there and explained to the faculty, you know, what problems they were encountering in Alabama, and could they kind of craft a program of study for him so he could learn anatomy and pathology and be able to go back and do forensic autopsies. So they actually came up with a program. He received a PhD in anatomical pathology and went back to Alabama and started doing postmortems. And this kind of rocked on until about 1942. He had married a woman in Auburn, and when they split up, he apparently decided he was going to leave Auburn, and he moved to Atlanta. And I think part of that was he had actually done some cases in Georgia, because, you know, Georgia had nobody that was qualified to do any forensic stuff in the 30s. So when the word kind of got out that, you know, there was these group of guys over there in Auburn, Alabama, that could do forensic stuff, and there were a lot of cases that actually got referred to Auburn back in the late 30s and early 40s. So I think he had built some relationships with some law enforcement people in Georgia, and they may have kind of suggested to him over the years, you know, gosh, you ought to come over here, and, you know, you could really help us out. So, you know, when the divorce happened, he did decide to come to Atlanta in 1942, and it was actually a really good thing for the state of Georgia.
It's amazing to think what a divorce did for the state, really.
Yeah. It really is. It really is. And you know what some of our listeners may find pretty interesting also, before we leave Alabama, they were actually the first state in the U.S. to establish a statewide crime laboratory. Most of the crime laboratories up to that time were located in large cities like, New York, Los Angeles, Detroit, things like that, Philadelphia. So you didn't have like a statewide laboratory. So Alabama was actually the first state to do that. They're not usually first in a lot of things, except maybe college football. But
amen.
So it was actually kind of an interesting factoid there. But when Doc came to Atlanta, and of course everybody always called him Doc. He was not a medical doctor. He had a PhD, but everybody called him Doc. And when he came to Atlanta, one of the first things that he was offered was a position at Oglethorpe University, which is a small university in Atlanta. And they wanted to start up their own medical school, and they actually hired him to help start up a medical school. So even though he wasn't a medical doctor, he had quite a reputation, even amongst the medical doctors at that time. He also did some freelance forensic work, working out of his lab at Oglethorpe for approximately 5 years. And then in about 1947, he was offered an opportunity to go with the Fulton County Police Department, which is the county that encompasses Atlanta. And they wanted to head up a new forensic laboratory that was had a very interesting, rather long name. It was called the Fulton County Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory. And it was housed in a office building that I don't even think exists anymore. And he had a staff of one or two people, and not only did they work cases for Fulton County, but he also, one of the agreements that he made the county go with was he wanted to be able to work cases all over the state. And it was actually a good deal for the county, because when he worked cases outside of the Atlanta area, he would bill the agency, so the county actually collected some money, which I guess kind of helped pay for the whole forensic operation. But what made Herman Jones so unique is that he had a lot of good things going for him that made him a good forensic scientist. Number one, he had a very strong scientific background. He had a teaching background. He know science, but when he went out and worked with people at crime scenes and stuff, he was able to teach them things. Mm-hmm. And what people have told me that one of his best qualities was the fact that he just had a lot of good old-fashioned common sense. Mm-hmm. And he had an ability to be able to reason his way through a problem. And he also had a great servant heart. He was willing to go wherever he was needed in those early days. It didn't matter what time of the day or night. If the phone rang, he'd get up and go. And mm-hmm. It was that kind of commitment that really won over so many people all across the state, law enforcement people, coroners, state and local politicians. And that's what really eventually spearheaded the movement to get the Georgia legislature to appropriate enough money to start their own state lab and to make him the head of it. And even though there had been attempts, of course it finally came into fruition in 1952, but there had actually been some attempts early on, right after he came to Georgia. Like in 1944, I remember there was an actual attempt to try to lure him away from Oglethorpe and start up a state lab. But you know, the kind of the rub as far as Jones was concerned was that he feared that the laboratory and his position in the laboratory would become kind of too political. You know, he would be kind of working at the you know, at the pleasure of the governor, and he just feared that every time there was a change in the governor's office, you know, there was a possibility that, you know, he would not be reappointed. So that's why he never really kind of jumped in, and it wasn't really until 1952 that the state actually agreed to set the lab up in a way that, you know, all the employees were under the merit system, and, you know, their jobs were protected, and they couldn't be hired and fired every time there was a change in the governor's office.
Well, he really had, you know, I think that was what fascinated me in the book is that it's not, it's in part just getting a good sense of how this lab, you know, grew to be established. And as you said, you know, just in passing, the very solid scientific background that it had, which I have to tell you, you know, I don't have to tell you, but I need to tell our listeners, not every lab in this country started on a very solid scientific foundation like that one did. And it really, to have someone with those kinds of insights, he's really an incredible, just was an obviously an incredible individual, a lot of foresight.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so when you were doing all of this, did you have to, as you said, you didn't know him. So what? How did you get to know him?
Well, and I really think, I think I've actually put something in the foreword to the book that I really think it was an advantage to me not knowing him, because writing the, I think I was a lot more objective in writing about the man because I didn't know him. I didn't have the benefit of firsthand knowledge and, you know, people saying, well, of course you write some nice things for him, you know, you knew him, but I didn't know him. But I got to know him, you know, in kind of an unusual way, when in 2002, you know, I mentioned earlier, they did have like a 50th anniversary celebration. They had a little ceremony at our headquarters laboratory. And I, you know, there were some older former employees that came in, and I got to meet some people. And one of the folks that I kind of got to know pretty well was he had both Dr. Jones and his wife June, who you know, before I get too far into this, June Jones was quite a forensic scientist herself. She was a toxicologist, and it was you know, back in those days it was almost unheard of for women to work in forensic science. And to have like a husband and wife team working together was, you know, absolutely unheard of. And she, you know, she was quite a forensic scientist in her own right. In fact, readers may be interested to know that she was the first woman to become president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. So, you know, that tells you a little bit about her reputation amongst forensic scientists. But there was surprisingly very little information in, you know, within our own agency about how the laboratory got started. The only thing that I could really find when I kind of embarked on this project was they had a copy of a speech that Dr. Jones gave to the Medical Association of Georgia in the late 1960s, where he kind of explained to the group how the lab got started and, you know, what happened after he came to Atlanta in 42. But the first real bit of luck that I had is when I contacted one of his sons, Dwight, who lived in the Atlanta area, and obviously it was very easy to go see him because he was kind of close by. And I remember I showed up at his home one time, and he had this giant cardboard box that he had brought down out of the attic that he kind of dumped on the kitchen table and opened up the lid, and it was just chock full of all kinds of stuff. Apparently, June used to keep kind of like scrapbooks, and they had, you know, newspaper articles. They had photographs, and magazine articles, all kinds of stuff that they had accumulated all through their career, going all the way back to, you know, I actually found a picture in there from one of the first cases he ever did, I think, when he came to Georgia in 1942, a poisoning case. And, of course, a lot of this stuff wasn't labeled. You know, the newspaper articles, you know, of course, they'd have a date on them, or even if they were cut out, you couldn't find the date. You could sort of figure out the date just from the content. But there were a lot of pictures that didn't have any markings on them. And, you know, when I, you know, of course, you realize that they must have saved this for a reason. It must have meant something to them. It must have had a significance to them. And it, in some instances, it took years of before I actually figured out what some of the pictures actually were. But the box was just a treasure trove of information. Apparently, when their mother June passed away in the 80s. She had all this stuff that she'd kept, and the two boys just kind of divided it up. So Dwight had a box, and their other son in Florida, Doug, had a box. So, of course, I went to see Doug and, you know, went through his box. But that in itself was a great way to get started.
And that's then, amazing.
Yeah, and then, you know, and of course, I had a lot of good luck, too. You know, there would be occasions where former employees would just kind of show up at the front door of the lab and say, hey, you know, I used to work here, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they would know that I was doing some research, so they would, you know, if they'd call me up there to the front if I happened to be in the building that day and get to talk to them. And, you know, as you start to pick up little turn over rocks here and there, you start chasing a rabbit, and then before you know it, you start getting leads on other former employees, because you know, I found out a lot of these people that maybe worked in the lab in the 50s and 60s, when they left, a lot of them kind of kept up with each other, so I was able to track down other folks, you know, from the leads I'd gotten from the people that I'd met earlier. So it just started opening a lot of doors. And of course, at that point, looking at all the, you know, having all the newspaper articles and stuff like that, I already knew a little bit of stuff. So you know, one of the things that I kind of learned early on was, if I'd go and sit down with some of these older employees, I would always start off the interview by asking them some questions that I already knew the answer to, kind of to check their memory. You know, it's you know, I didn't want to fall into a trap where, you know, I was hearing stories and thinking they were true, and, you know, write them down, and then only to find out later, or somebody point out to me later, that, you know, this never happened. So I was able to, you know, I was able to kind of quiz people enough to where I could kind of tell whether or not that they really remembered things or they didn't. And, you know, there were some folks that I enjoyed visiting with them, but, you know, I couldn't rely on anything they told me, because they clearly just didn't remember stuff. But, you know, altogether, I guess I probably spent, you know, over the, you know, about 6 years in my spare time, you know, doing various research, chasing leads, and, you know, went over to, you know, I made a trip to Florida, like I said, to visit with one of the sons. I went to Auburn, spent a day in Auburn one day trying to track down some information about him. And, you know, once I really got into it, I realized that I had so much information that instead of just doing a 10-page paper, you know, I could write a book. So that's kind of what happened. And, you know, I was kind of glad that I did it. I didn't write it, you know, to sell a bunch of copies and to make money doing it. I just wanted all that information to be put in a book form, so people that came, you know, after me 10, 15, 20 years down the road, if they had the same interest that I did, they would be able to pick up the book and know how it all started.
Yeah, and well, it's I just want to, like I said, I want to recommend it as a resource, especially for any of our listeners who are writing about forensic science or crime fiction set in these earlier periods. It's a great resource. Well, you yourself spent a long time and years that were seeing big changes. So what would you say in your own career, what were some of the biggest changes that occurred in forensic science over that time?
Well, I guess I'd have to say, you know, the first thing that always comes to mind when I get that question is the adaptation of DNA typing in forensics. You know, when I first came on, I really thought when I was in graduate school that I wanted to go into the serology or forensic biology area. So I was, you know, I was a little bit familiar with the technology at the time, and you know, back then the typing of enzymes in blood was kind of the big thing back then, which allowed you to basically break it down a little bit more specifically than just what they were doing back then, which was like doing an ABO blood type. And as you know, that, you know, that doesn't really narrow down the field very much. So the enzyme typing was the big thing, but gosh, when DNA technology came along, I mean, it basically revolutionized forensic science, because you could practically individualize a biological fluid like blood or semen. But you know, throughout my whole career, I think I've you know, new technology has always made its way into the forensic sciences. It's as far as I'm concerned, it's always been a continuing process of improvement. You know, I've seen automated instrumentation, for example. You know, I can remember when scientists used to have to take a little syringe and inject their samples into a gas chromatograph when they were doing drug identification or accelerant identification, and now they can load all these samples up in vials and put them in an auto sampler at the end of the day, and you know, when they come back in the morning, all the samples have been run for them. You know, we have the automated fingerprint identification system, you know, where you can take an unknown fingerprint and search it against thousands and thousands of prints in just minutes. So, you know, that crime labs have always made use of new technology, and they will continue to do so. And it's not only does it make the process faster, but I think a lot of this new technology makes the results better and easier to defend, I think, in court.
Well, when you worked at the Georgia State Lab, you obviously worked in a lot of different areas. What are some of the hats you wore during that time, the areas that you were working in?
Well, Doug, I considered myself really fortunate, because when I came along pretty early on, I was afforded the opportunity to train and to go to a new regional facility that they were thinking about opening down in the central part of the state in Macon. And I think I was probably the last person in our system who had actually received the kind of training that allowed them to be what I used to call a generalist. Basically, that meant that I was trained to work in multiple forensic science disciplines instead of just kind of specializing in one. So, you know, I was sort of groomed for that. And, you know, the fact that I had received a master's degree in forensic chemistry before I came to Georgia, to the system, that also kind of, you know, put me in a kind of a unique position, because I had already had some exposure to multiple disciplines as a part of that training. So, you know, when I had the opportunity to go to a regional lab, you know, there was only going to be three scientists down there. So we had one that did toxicology, we had one that did drug identification, and then you had me, who basically did, you know, everything else. And the lab was set up, we covered a 23-county area in the central part of the state. And I did everything from firearms and tool marks to just about all of the trace evidence areas, things like hairs and fibers, paint, glass, shoe and tire impressions, arson and explosives residues. I did some latent fingerprint processing, did some lamp filament testing, and some very basic screening of, you know, blood samples, and also did crime scene work, and, you know, of course, had to learn how to do the fingerprint processing as part of the crime scene work. So, you know, I used to teach at some of the police in-service classes down in the area, and I always like to say that in my spare time, they even had me doing some marijuana testing. So, you know, I did a little bit of everything, and, you know, I was young, and I was, you know, I just loved what I was doing, and, you know, the fact that I was, that I stayed busy every day was a great thing as far as I was concerned. But the, you know, the generalist concept was, you know, beginning to kind of go away. I know it's always been very popular in California and in some other areas, but when accreditation and especially proficiency testing started to come along, it became kind of an expensive proposition to have to take multiple proficiency tests every year. You know, if you're doing all these different subdisciplines, you know, you have to take a lot of proficiency tests, and then you have to try to keep current with new methodology and, you know, attending meetings and getting training. And in some of the areas, for example, you might only get a handful of cases every year. So, you know, if you, like, say, for, you know, if you were a glass analyst, you know, I might only get one or two, three cases maybe that would come in the door every year for glass comparison. So it kind of became a situation where is it really cost effective to, you know, make you take a proficiency test every year for in glass when you're only working on a couple of cases. And, you know, we started looking at the economies, I guess, of all that. And, you know, decisions started to get made that, you know, if even if, you know, if you figure all across the whole state, let's say we only get, you know, two or three dozen glass cases that come in for the whole state in a given year, isn't it better maybe to let one or two individuals just do those so they can gain a little more experience and expertise, and, you know, being able to say that, you know, when you go into court, you can say, you know, I've worked, you know, 100 or so of these cases, whereas as opposed to going into court and say, well, how many glass comparisons you ever done? Well, I've done 5. You know, it just doesn't sound as convincing to a jury that you really know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, during your tenure there, were there any cases that you found particularly compelling or memorable?
Oh, of course. Gosh, you know, people ask me that all the time, but you know, I wished at the time I'd sort of kind of written down stuff about some of these cases, but you know, every once in a while, like, I'll run into somebody that was a prosecutor or something like that, and he said, yeah, I remember a case you did for me, and blah, 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 and he starts telling me about this case, and I'm thinking, like, gosh, I don't even remember this thing. But, yeah, there were, you know, one or two that, you know, that when I look back over my career, I was just like, you know, gosh, those were cases that really almost helped me gain some confidence and got me, I don't know, feeling better about my abilities. You know, I had one pretty early on that was largely a circumstantial case, a murder case, and a young woman who, she was about 20 years old, she got kidnapped, she was tortured, sexually assaulted, and eventually killed and dumped in a creek. And, you know, fortunately she had phoned somebody before she disappeared, and she had kind of told her friend that she was going to meet an individual about a possible job. And really what kind of got the police on his trail, but, you know, it was really a trace evidence, hairs and fiber evidence that really helped, you know, link him to her body. And another case that that I remember pretty well that happened, it was the day after New Year's in 1995. I remember it very well. There were two college students from the Macon area that were found shot to death in a car alongside a lake just north of Macon. They had been to a movie that night, and they went to see the movie. I don't know if you remember the movie called. It was called IQ. It had Meg Ryan and Tim Robbins uh-huh. in it. It was a real funny, kind of cute movie. And if you remember the very last scene of the movie, they go out and they're in a convertible, I think, and they're parked in a field and they're watching this comet go by. And I think when this couple saw this scene, they decided after the movie they were going to go find a place where they could go park and just kind of look at the stars. And they were just sitting in the car out there, and it was just a totally random act. Somebody came in with two weapons and shot the car all to, you know, 14, 15 times, and then approached the car with a handgun after that, and basically executed the fellow who was still alive. And it took almost 2 years before they actually identified the perpetrator. And the reason they were able to identify the person was we were pretty conclusively able to tell the investigators exactly what type of weapons they were looking for. We had narrowed down based on the characteristics we saw in the cartridge cases and the bullets that it had to be a Colt AR-15 rifle and a Ruger 9mm pistol. And it was basically some old-fashioned police work that they basically started going around. The case got so cold, they just started going around checking pawn records for anybody who had pawned one of these AR-15s. And turns out that they got several names, and they started going around talking to these people. And one of them that they talked to, it kind of spooked him, and he disappeared. And turned out his father was a FBI agent working in the area down there, and it was kind of a bittersweet ending to the whole affair, because the young fella wound up actually confessing to his dad, who was an agent, and of course his testimony actually helped send his son to death row. So it kind of highlighted the fact to me that, you know, there's really no winners when you're investigating a murder. You know, there's everybody loses,
right?
And it, you know, was mm-hmm. another reminder too that you know, the work that you do is can really have some pretty serious consequences. So literally life and death. And you know, it was just a reminder, but it was something that really had been kind of drilled into me, you know, early in my training, that, you know, your testimony can sometimes send somebody to death row.
Mm. Well, and yeah, and also just how far out from the just the victim and the murderer the number of people are who are affected by we sort of think in terms of those two sets of people, but it's, you know, their families, the community, it's
the ripple,
it's really
yeah.
Well, to kind of shift gears a little bit here, you've been active in the American Society of Crime Lab Directors, known as ASCLAD, and you've served on the board. Tell us about that organization and its work.
Well, Jan, you know, ASCLAD basically started, or the idea of it was started back in 1973 when the head of the FBI lab, Dr. Briggs White, recognized that there was a need to have greater cooperation between the state and local and federal laboratories. So he actually persuaded the FBI director at the time, Clarence Kelly, to organize a meeting, and they brought in many of the directors from the country's top crime labs. And basically out of that meeting was birthed the American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors. And although it started basically as a professional organization of just laboratory directors, it's now its membership has been broadened to basically include all layers of crime laboratory management. Its purpose basically is to assist the development of laboratory management principles and techniques, to improve communications among crime labs, and to promote and maintain the highest standards of practice. I was very privileged to be elected to serve on that on their board of directors for 3 years, beginning in 2004. And it really kind of opened my eyes to some of the big challenges that the profession of forensic science was beginning to face.
Mm. Well, you've also been involved in lab accreditation, which is also, it's not the only organization we understand, but ASCRAD is involved in that as well. And so you've been involved in lab accreditation. Why should our listeners want their local lab to become accredited?
Well, accreditation is, you know, I think it's a little bit misunderstood by some people. You know, I personally think it's probably the best thing that's happened to the profession since I've been in the field. But, you know, one of the big misconceptions about accreditation is that, you know, it's going to prevent mistakes from happening. And unfortunately, that's not the case. Basically, all accreditation ensures is that
humans
that a laboratory has developed a quality management system, and that they have you know, developed policies and procedures that are going to be standardized throughout their laboratory and throughout their system if it's a state system. It doesn't mean that you know, mistakes won't happen. It should make mistakes easier to catch. You know, before accreditation, there were all kinds of mistakes probably that just get swept under the rug. I know, you know, every laboratory system has got their skeletons that they've buried in the closet over the years. And, you know, with accreditation, at least now when problems occur, they have to conduct an investigation to determine what happened, what the root cause was, and to take the proper steps with the approval of the accrediting body that grants them the accreditation to ensure that the problem is corrected so it won't happen again. So everything now is pretty much out in the open, and I think it's one of the reasons that you hear more news stories about problems in crime lab, just because there is increased transparency now. But, you know, any profession, whether it's doctors, athletes, members of the clergy, teachers, lawyers, scientists, I mean, it's all these professions, they're made up of human beings. And, you know, we're all human, we make mistakes, and sometimes unfortunately, we behave in an inappropriate manner too. So, you know, accreditation just doesn't prevent bad things from happening. It just helps you to be able to detect them. You should be able to weed these problems out a lot faster when you have a quality management system. And, you know, forensics labs really they really need to do their due diligence and do everything they can up front, you know, before they hire people, you know, doing a thorough background check before they hire somebody. You know, a lot of them have a very robust program where they do random drug testing to try to circumvent some of the issues that, you know, if we see crop up in the news all the time about people taking drugs out of the evidence and I think labs, the management also has to do a better job, I think, to manage the amount of workload that they put on their folks, and to properly supervise them to help prevent some of these ethical lapses from taking place. But, you know, I don't think people realize how stressful the job is, and it shouldn't really be a surprise that, you know, people get addicted to drugs.
I couldn't agree with you more strongly. You know, I think it's absolutely necessary, and people haven't realized that in a lot of the labs there aren't these quality control things in place.
Right.
Well, darn, we have so much more to ask you, but we've run out of time for this episode. I'd love to talk with you again if we can ever do that, and have really appreciated all you've had to say to us tonight.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. It went by so quick.
It did.
Well, thank you, everyone, and please be sure to look on our website at Crime and Science Radio and at the Suspense Magazine website as well. We have links and more information up there, and we'll just hope that one day Jay will come back and talk to us again. Thank you, Jay.
Okay. Thank you.